And partially due to its popularity as a porno search term, anal sex is considered normal. According to surveys published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, the percentage of 18 to 24-year-old women who reported trying it rose from 16% in 1992 to 40% in 2009, with about 70% of them saying they experienced pain in the process. I should state for the record that I am not, by any stretch of the imagination, anti-pornography. I've seen a great deal of it, as my first writing job entailed reviewing it, and I don't think it's inherently bad, albeit when viewed by adults who have enough common sense to know every heterosexual encounter shouldn't end with the man ejaculating on the woman's face. In porn videos in which sexual aggression is part of the action, which a recent analysis of over 6,000 scenes found 33% were, women almost always resist said aggression, then lean back and enjoy getting sport-fucked. The difference between those women and real women, however, is that they're being paid to do so, a thought that probably doesn't cross most 14-year-olds' minds. Could that explain why the vast majority of the 20-somethings raised on pornography I've had sex with over the years have fucked me like I owe them money? Who's to say? Regardless of the act itself, the language used to describe good sex varies between the genders. Men are more likely to talk about pleasure and orgasm, while women more likely to talk about the absence of pain. Wait, we're still satisfying men's needs while ignoring our own? But I thought being seen as a sex object was empowering. At least that's what the media tells us. For the duplicity of this argument, look no further than to mercifully deceased self-identified feminist Hugh Hefner, a man who once hosted an Equal Rights Amendment fundraiser at the Playboy Mansion, yet also, in its namesake magazine, disseminated a thoroughly distorted view of what the ideal woman should be. "She is never sophisticated," he said. "She is a young, healthy, simple girl. We are not interested in the mysterious, difficult woman." Wrapping Playboy in feminist rhetoric gave it an air of respectability and progressivism. But if you want to know what the brand really stood for, read Gloria Steinem's career-making piece about going undercover as a Playboy bunny, where she was subjected to a painful and pointless pelvic exam and told, quote, "We don't like our girls to have any background. We just want you to fit the bunny image," in order to earn less than minimum wage for serving drinks to grabby businessmen. As time has worn on, what constitutes female sexiness and sexual empowerment has maintained the patriarchal status quo. Think Wonder Woman with her golden lasso and a heaving bosom, or a lip-glossed, pube-waxed pop star undulating in front of a giant projection of the word feminist. It's impossible not to notice that when female artists, quote, take control over their own image and reclaim their sexuality, it always invariably fits that age-old mold of well-manicured traditional fuckability. While feminists of earlier generations protested objectification, today's feminists see it as a choice, a personal expression as opposed to a requirement. Yet dressing in the traditional trappings of revealing clothing makes one feel both empowered and powerless at the same time, as any woman who's had her bubble burst by being catcalled walking down the street in anything revealing her kneecaps can testify. Yet still, most girls' clothing emphasizes body consciousness at a young age. Bikinis for infants, skinny jeans for toddlers. And don't get me started on Abercrombie's goddamn thongs for preteens, aka children, with wink wink and eye candy printed on them. Even now on Aeropostale's website is the copy, "Live, Love, Dream. Shop cute and comfortable thongs for teen girls and women." The words "comfortable" and "fabric constantly rubbing against my asshole" have never gone together in my vocabulary, but maybe I'm insane. Long gone are the days in which married couples on television didn't even sleep in the same bed. Today, the average teen is exposed to nearly 14,000 references to sex on TV every year, and 70% of primetime TV has sexual content. As a result, young people who consume this objectifying media report more of a willingness to engage in sexualized behavior and find it empowering. I can't help but see this as brainwashing, but as always, I'm a prude if I'm against it. So go ahead, call me a prude. I've been called worse. The C word. Multiple times. Mostly by anonymous men on the internet.
What can be said in summary? There is little doubt that we are seeing an increased openness, an increased permissiveness. Will this trend continue? Where are we heading?
You know, I was reminded of that Peggy Ornstein book, which is called Girls and Sex.
Yeah.
Well, you read that book, right? Or parts of it?
I did.
So the biggest takeaway for me was that little girls in junior high school are now giving oral sex to boys, which is miles and miles away from makeout parties that they had when I was in junior high school.
Same, yes.
Here's the weirdest part was they're doing this for the boys because they think the boys like it. And obviously the boys do, but they get nothing in return.
Mm-hmm.
So you're telling me, I mean, Peggy Orenstein is telling us both that today's modern revolutionary teens are still getting nothing in terms of sex. They're starting movements that are changing our country, and the girls are still getting nothing?
That would sadly appear to be the case, yeah.
The other thing that I was really thinking about was, so you're saying that 70% of women are still faking orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's down from 100%.
Or is there a statistic above 100? Is that over 110%?
On the other hand, I was thinking that, all right, they're still faking orgasms, but I bet they're faking them very differently than they used to in the 1800s or the 1700s, having watched all those porn films they teach you that an orgasm sounds like a woman having her oxygen cut off and screaming like a strangled chicken.
Well, I mean, often, depending on what kind of pornography we're watching, that could be the actual case.
I also would like to mention that I really like how the San Francisco Chronicle reporter called the Chinese sex slaves the particularly fine portions of the cargo, the fresh and pretty females who fill special orders. It's like they're tropical fruit, like a tray of mangoes. Look, the mangoes are ripe. Horrible.
I'm wondering, where they were on the boat, too, in the context of the actual fruit. I'm sure it's like below the fruit.
I had no idea, really, that amount of Chinese women were
Neither did I either. That was insane
that
to find that out.
Really horrifying. But I was happy to hear that Hugh Hefner saying, we're not interested in the mysterious, difficult woman.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I wasn't happy to hear it, because if only I'd known, I would have changed my entire persona just from the get-go. What did he say that I really liked? A young, healthy, simple girl.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I would have called my first book. A young, healthy, simple girl. Who doesn't want to be that?
I mean, I guess it doesn't matter anymore, because now he's dead.
Yeah.
We'll never get to get HPV from the grotto.
He will be missed. Chapter 4, Religion.
Augustine, Calvin, and Luther said women brought sinning and shame.
St. Thomas Aquinas thought those with vaginas should just
put the laundry away. Putting the laundry away.
This chapter is about the indignities of being a woman, subheading religion. But before we start, now might be a good time to remind you that not only are we not being thorough, given the parameters of this project, you can safely assume we've left out almost everything.
Yeah, any one of these topics could fill a million billion books, which, by the way, was our original pitch to Audible. Sadly, they said no. But as luck would have it, we are the kind of magical creatures who can consolidate a million billion books worth of intensive data into concise, easily digestible, dare I say snackable, segments of content.
So, religion. You know, I feel very strongly that there are not going to be any indignities heaped upon womankind here.
You know, studies have found that women are far more likely to be religious than men, so it would be unthinkable to imagine that the big religions haven't taken that into account and tailored their content to offer the specific base the comfort and support it deserves.
Of course, that just makes sense. But if there are any indignities here, well, you know, I think I can already feel the hate mail forming in the ether. Religion seems to inspire a lot of passionate feelings in people.
You mean in that it's been the root cause of countless wars? Yeah, I think passionate's an accurate descriptor.
I'm actually starting to get paranoid that maybe we're going to be crucified just for talking about it.
Well, if Bill Maher hasn't been killed yet for everything he said about Muslims, I think we'll be okay.
But we're women's.
So you mean we can never be on Bill Maher's writing stand?
Maybe if we rewrite this chapter very carefully and take out anything negative that may have been said and then start to seriously rethink every single thing about the way we've lived our lives so far and repent. You know, I'm worried you're not willing to do that.
I think you're underestimating how far I'd go to get a staff job, Mel.
When I started to research this chapter, I decided the focus would be about how women were viewed by the biggest religions back in the beginning, when the whole thing started. Because the reason these religions took hold in the first place is all the original self-proclaimed holy men said they'd been interacting with God one-on-one. Then they helped to create societies in which members of one sex were encouraged to oppress members of the other sex, and then both sexes were taught to call it a natural state ordained by the Creator. So, let's revisit the advice God supposedly gave those guys about women. Of course, the earliest religions were polytheistic, as in worshiping many gods. For example, ancient Egypt had a religion based on the cycles of nature, the rising and setting sun, the moon's monthly cycle, the seasons. All that plus 2,000 gods of both sexes, including Isis, the ancient goddess from whom all others were derived. A promising start. More importantly for our purposes, the women of ancient Egypt were allowed to run businesses, borrow money, and own property. Way to go, ancient Egypt! The ancient Greeks had 12 gods and goddesses. Then the ancient Romans had basically the same 12 with slightly different names. Of this bunch, Zeus, the head Roman god, was hands down the rapiest. He was so into rape that he was not above turning himself into golden rain if it might get him some unwilling sex. Come on, even a special effects wizard would have to work extra hours to convincingly turn a big buff lightning bolt-wielding guy in a drapery into a gold-colored seasonal precipitant that looked predatory. Of course, it was okay because in both Greece and Rome, women were considered inferior. But this was no glass ceiling, since mortal women who were raped by gods were very well regarded, which sadly didn't help the gender profile much, since also in Greek mythology, it was a woman, Pandora, who opened the forbidden box and brought plagues and unhappiness to mankind. But these are myths. To really hit the indignity motherlode, we need to descend into the behavior of humans. First up, Hinduism, said to be the oldest still existing religion. It started with a bang in 1500 BC by unveiling a pantheon of 33 million male and female and sometimes androgynous gods and goddesses. Book 1 starts out encouragingly by beginning with an ancient hymn declaring feminine energy the essence of the universe that creates all matter and consciousness. Hey, you may be thinking, and when I say you, I mean me, maybe I'll become a Hindu. And then you get to the laws of Manu, a series of rules passed down by Manu, the creator of mankind. Here are just a few of the laws about women. A woman should do nothing independently, even in her own house. In childhood, subject to her father, in youth to her husband, and when her husband is dead, to her sons. Or here's a fun one. Though he be uncouth and prone to pleasure, though he have no good points at all, the virtuous wife should ever worship her lord as a god. And by lord, Manu means husband, who, by the way, apparently has no good points at all. Which is, quite frankly, not that easy to achieve, so kudos to the lucky misses. And then there's this one. If a wife, proud of the greatness of her relatives or of her own excellence, violates the duty which she owes her lord, the king shall cause her to be devoured by dogs in a place frequented by many. Why many are choosing to frequent a place full of bloodthirsty, man-eating dogs is almost beside the point after you stumble upon number 64921 of the sacred writings called Upanishads, which tells us, surely a woman who has changed her clothes at the end of her menstrual period is the most auspicious of women. Therefore, one should approach that splendid woman and invite her to have sex. Should she refuse to consent, he should bribe her. If she still refuses, he should beat her with a stick or with his fists and overpower her, saying, I take away the splendor from you with my virility and splendor. To which I believe the appropriate response would have been, hey, hold on a second, buddy. Before we go any further, can we just take a moment to please define splendor? In them days, India was a hotbed of religious fun for the ladies, especially just a few years later when along came the Vedas, a religion in which women could only be saved if they were reborn as high-caste males. Credited to Brahma, the creator of the world, among their many gifts was a hearty thumbs-up to female infanticide, as stated in Atharva Veda 6.3.4. Let a female child be born somewhere else. Here, let a male child be born. Subtle. But for a real glimpse into how the Vedas felt about the ladies, let's turn very briefly to what is called the greatest Vedic ritual, a fertility rite called Ashvamedha, performed to make sure that more sons than daughters were on their way. In this ritual, a special horse was designated as sacred, which you know right off the bat is not going to end well for the horse. So the priest toured this beautiful horse around for all to see, and at the end of a full year, the Raja's wife was brought in to watch the horse sacrificed. Already you may be thinking, ew, leave that beautiful horse alone. And of course, here where I say you, I mean me. But hang on, the spirit of their main god, Indra, who, by the way, said of women, the mind of woman cannot be disciplined. She has very little intelligence.
anyway, the spirit of Indra enters the dead horse, after which the Raja's wife is required to fuck him. And by him, I mean the dead horse. Of course, considering the nice things Indra had to say about women, maybe the dead horse is the better date. Meanwhile, all the priests and other wives stand around and make, quote, bawdy conversation. A big joke from that time must have gone, "Hey, Ananya, good news and bad news. The good news? The Raja wants to marry you. You will have riches. You will be the queen. The bad news? It's time for Ashvamedha." Meanwhile, over in China, seemed like women were doing okay-ish under Taoism with its yin and yang philosophy, even though women were yin, associated with water, death, and decline, and men were yang, associated with life, growth, and light. When, wouldn't you know it, along comes Confucius, whose teachings dominated all aspects of Chinese life for centuries, and who preferred women to be controlled by men from cradle to grave. "Most all families have sons and daughters," he said. "When the sons go out to school, they seek instruction from a teacher on how to chant poetry, how to write essays. Daughters remain behind in the women's quarters and should not be allowed to go out very often. Teach them sewing, cooking, etiquette. On the bright side, not a single mention of sex with dead horses." The 5th century was such a great time to be a woman. If Trump ever finds out that there were other centuries, he's going to start wearing a hat that says, "Make America the 5th century again." Take, for example, this story by the classic Greek scholar Herodotus, known as the father of history, who wrote about his travels to Babylon, which is now Iraq, where he witnessed firsthand how religion was helping women become more spiritual through the holy act of degrading humiliation. "The foulest custom is one which compels every woman of the land to sit in the temple of Aphrodite and have intercourse with some stranger at least once in her life. Many women who are rich and proud and disdain to mingle with the rest drive to the temple in covered carriages drawn by teams and stand there with a great retinue of attendants. But most sit down in the sacred plot of Aphrodite with crowns of cords on their heads. There is a great multitude of women coming and going as the men pass and make their choice. Once a woman has taken her place, she does not go away to her home before some stranger has cast money into her lap and had intercourse with her outside the temple. But while he casts the money, he must say, 'I invite you in the name of Mylitta,' a goddess associated with Aphrodite. It does not matter what sum the money is. The woman will never refuse, for that would be a sin, the money being by this act made sacred. So she follows the first man who casts it and rejects no one. After their intercourse, having discharged her sacred duty to the goddess, she goes away to her home, and thereafter there is no bribe, however great, that will get her. However, the uncomely have long to wait because they cannot fulfill the law. Some of them remain for 3 years or four." In other words, waiting 4 years for 4 minutes of bad sex with a stranger, which, now that I think about it, averages out to about 1 minute of bad sex a year, which is really not all that bad, considering. But now it's time for a collective sigh of relief because, although it's still 500 BC, let's welcome the start of Buddhism. Ah, Buddhism, religion of stylish intellectuals and yoga teachers. Because Buddhist tradition, as we all know, promotes equality between males and females. Kind of. Well, not really. Gautama Buddha, the founder of Buddhism, felt that women could not achieve enlightenment or Buddhahood, which, of course, is the whole point, without first being reborn as men. Not even the nagging of his own stepmother could make him change his mind. Hopefully, she had more luck arguing with him when she returned in her next life as his stepfather. Want to know what the biggest flashpoint of every popular and enduring religion turned out to be? The common enemy of the spiritual man turns out to be menstrual blood. It's the one true abomination on which the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims, and the Hindus can all agree. Starting with Shintoism, the disgust was influenced by the popularity of the Buddhist Blood Pond Sutra, which describes how a disciple of the Buddha descended to hell to save his mother. Why his mother went to hell, I can't tell you. Maybe because she gave birth to him? Anyway, he found her in a group of women who were being forced by the hell wardens to drink their own menstrual blood, something no one anywhere really recommends. Turns out mom and her pals actually deserved this punishment because when a woman has her period, she soils the ground, offends the earth gods, and pollutes the very rivers from which the holy men draw water to make tea. And I ask you, do not these holy men deserve a less disgusting form of tea? Relatively speaking, the Quran takes sort of a moderate position. When they ask you about menstruation, say it's an illness.
Therefore, keep aloof from the women during the menstrual discharge,
and do not go near them until they have become clean. That's milder than the Jewish tradition, which forbids men from interacting with menstruating women entirely. The Jewish Old Testament has scores of rules about isolating a woman on her period because she is dangerously unclean. If any man lie with her at all, and her flowers be upon him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and all the bed whereon he lieth shall also be unclean, unquote. In other words, anyone who touches anything she sat on must immediately wash their clothes and bathe in water, but they will still remain unclean until the evening. The unclean woman was so problematic to the Jewish holy men that in Leviticus 12:1-5, God himself states that, quote, a woman who becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son will be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. But if she gives birth to a daughter, the woman will be unclean for 2 weeks, as during her period. In other words, a baby girl is a double-strength bundle of filth, which I guess in a way is the earliest known reference to girl power. And Judaism started out so hopeful, too, with its matrilineal structure of Jewishness being passed on through the mother. But gender hierarchies are so deeply entrenched in Judaism that the blessing Orthodox Jewish men are required to say every day goes like this. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman, a Gentile, or a boor. Fun fact, if you combine all three, woman, Gentile, and boor, voila, the Old Testament hath predicted Ann Coulter, Kellyanne Conway, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Also, according to Jewish law, men and women must be separated during prayer by placing women on a second-floor balcony, because men are not permitted to see women during prayer, but women are allowed to see the men praying. Maybe not the first documented instance of narcissism. Religion has too many to count. But come on, this sure sounds like a case of, hey, gals, you want to see some real praying? I got you praying over here. But it gets even more Handmaid's Tale in the anecdote about a man who was unsure if he married a virgin, wherein, if no proof of the young woman's virginity can be found, she shall be brought to the door of her father's house, and there the men of her town shall stone her to death. But hold on, good times were just around the corner, as we see in an anecdote found in Nedarim 25, a part of the Talmud, which is the ancient book of sacred Jewish civil and ceremonial law. A woman came before Rabbi and complained of her husband's sodomy with her, to which Rabbi replied, wherein does it differ from fish? A man may do whatever he pleases with his wife at intercourse, as meat which comes from the abattoir may be eaten salted, roasted, cooked, or seething. So too with fish from the fishmonger. You know, appealing as that metaphor is for a wife to literally be likened unto a fish or meat, it's surprising that seething meat from the abattoir isn't one of the beloved traditional side dishes served every year at Passover dinner. Which brings us to Christianity, which of course started out female-friendly with Jesus insisting that women, slaves, and the poor actually mattered. Jesus' 5 best friends all appear to have been women. Mary of Bethany, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna, and Salome. Question. Who remained praying at Jesus' cross when he was crucified, then arranged his burial, then returned to find his tomb empty? Who then worked to create a vast network of churches to pass on his message? Yep, women. In fact, in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, there were women priests and prophets. But, as usual, his followers didn't share his acceptance. By 100 AD, the Christian man who wrote the gospel decided to, go in a different direction, by which I mean the usual direction. You know, it's interesting how in Genesis, Adam, who is the very first man, and only in existence for a number of hours, immediately throws Eve under the bus. When God asks him, have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from? Adam instantly replies, that woman you put here with me, she gave me the fruit from the tree and I ate it. Just one page before, Adam was calling her bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. But God asks him one little question and boom, she turns into that woman you put here. In other words, in one fell swoop, Adam learns in the future, if anything goes wrong, just blame the woman. And if that fails, try blaming God. And of course, at this point, God says to Adam in response, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, which certainly turned out to be a ball that men could pick up and run with. Credit where credit is due. Eve only ate that fruit because it offered knowledge.
False advertising when you consider how every religion still managed to call her feeble-minded.
Anyway, by the 1st century, St. Paul the Apostle was preaching to the world, wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. And then there was Tertullian, the father of Latin Christianity and the founder of Western theology, who suddenly chimed in, adding, "And do you not know that you are each an Eve? The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives on in this age. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You, who destroyed so easily God's image. Even the Son of God had to die." And while we're honoring Tertullian, let's not forget that quote of his that should have been his blues classic, "Woman is a temple built over a sewer." Cut to the Middle Ages and St. Thomas Aquinas, considered by many to be the most influential thinker in Christian history, who said, "As regards the individual nature, woman is defective and misbegotten. The production of woman comes from a defect in the active force." And by the way, this was 800 years before Star Wars. Up next, we'll skip merrily past the surprisingly equal opportunity greatest hits of the Catholic Inquisition, which lasted, get this, 500 years. By the time Martin Luther, the religious reformer of the 1500s, joined the party and added, "The word and works of God is quite clear, that women were made either to be wives or prostitutes. No gown worse becomes a woman than the desire to be wise." It was just piling on. Next thing you know, it was 1603, and our cultural ancestors, the beloved Puritans of Plymouth Rock and their leader John Dodd, were handing out his Puritan guidebook and praying, "Even as the church must fear Christ Jesus, so must the wives also fear their husbands. For if there be not fear and reverence in the inferior, there can be no sound nor constant honor yielded to the superior." Oh, and pass the cranberry sauce. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And we're just now getting to Islam, which I save for last, hoping that I would run out of time before I had a chance to anger some of our touchiest religious observers. Islam began in the 6th century and, like the others, got off to kind of a good start with many women supporters. Also, by allowing married women to retain property and inheritance rights, and by making education of women a sacred obligation so women could study the Quran. Fun fact, some of this was inspired by Khadija, Muhammad's first wife, a wealthy and successful businesswoman who was 15 years his senior and who supported him while he was becoming a prophet. Muhammad was no ageist, and no one could accuse him of having a type. His next wife, Aisha, who became an outspoken Muslim scholar and military leader, was 6 when he married her, and he was 50. But to be fair, he didn't consummate the marriage until she was 10. Even though women were his earliest supporters, well, one thing led to another, and the next thing you know, it was written that there are many perfect men, but no perfect women. And also, a woman's testimony counts half of a man's testimony. Though given how prone to exaggeration a lot of men are, maybe that was just an attempt at a bell curve correction. Then there's the passage that goes, "If you fear high-handedness from your wives, remind them of the teaching of God. Then ignore them when you go to bed. Then hit them." Since high-handedness is a pretty poorly defined term, I guess it's up to the husband to define it. No wonder Mohammed, quote, "looked at hell and saw that the majority of its inhabitants were women." But then again, since every big religion helped collaborate on the concept of hell, it makes sense that they also created doctrine that guaranteed they could populate it. For extra credit, ask Mr. Google to tell you all about Sharia law.
Why have dudes been so grossed out by menstrual blood for centuries? Like, do they think it has cooties? Is every man in the cloth actually an 8-year-old boy standing on his friend's shoulders under a cloak? What's the deal?
You know, I wonder about that, too. It's amazing how men just see women as a mysterious receptacle of filth.
Well, I guess we absorb their filth when they ejaculate in us, so...
Yeah, that's more graphic than I ever hoped to hear.
Speaking of period stuff, I mean, I gotta say, that's kind of one of the many reasons why I'm sad I'm not a Jew, is that I'd like an excuse not to interact with men whenever I'm on my period. Wouldn't you like that?
You know, I was thinking that maybe this whole thing with how the period is so such an anathema, so grotesque through history, is when I was growing up, where you weren't allowed to say you had your period, it was just you were not allowed to say it. So you had to use buzzwords for it. So like in grade school, I remember people saying things like, "Oh, Aunt Sarah is coming to visit," or "Aunt Sadie," or something.
Well, I remember, too, like how you couldn't just carry a tampon to the bathroom in school. You know, you had to slip it under the cuff of your shirt?
Yeah, it never made any sense to me why it was such a big secret, but maybe that's the reason.
Regardless, I would like to go back to the days in which we could just sit in a hut for 5 days a month. It seems kind of like a nice staycation situation.
Yeah, especially if it's a kind of a nice hut. Maybe catered, maybe
right.
Drinks.
As long as it has central air, I don't care where the hut is. It's not that I didn't already know this, but I found it pretty interesting when you sort of gave us the reminder that Christ was a woke ally.
I was interested to read that, too, that apparently the church didn't start out to be as lunatic as it ended up. It was apparently very feminine friendly in the very beginning.
Why do you think it changed?
I don't know. Maybe someone saw a woman getting her period and they just went, that's it. I'm done. No.
That's understandable. As a 90s kid, not only do I remember ABC's TGIF lineup with depressing specificity, I also remember growing up without shame following my every move or the fear of a bearded white guy in the sky wagging his finger in disapproval whenever I had impure thoughts about Urkel. I thought this was standard operating procedure for all girls of my generation, but it wasn't until much later that I realized my childhood was an anomaly. Being raised by an atheist father and an apathetic mother meant I spent my formative years blissfully unaware of the power of religious dogma to restrict people's actions. And if there's one thing I eventually learned about pretty much all major religions, though, it's that they frown on letting your freak flag fly, especially if you're a woman. Hell, even Scientology, which seems egalitarian on the surface because the ultimate state a follower can achieve, thetan, is genderless, implemented a rule in the 80s that members couldn't remain in the Sea Org, the church's highest-ranking organization, if they decided to have children, which resulted in many female members being pressured into getting abortions. Not to mention the fact that L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of the religion, kicked his second wife in the stomach in an unsuccessful attempt to induce one. I know why I was so naive. I was taught in school that America was built on religious freedom and the separation of church and state, yet Christianity has always been and remains the law of the land. 90% of the founding fathers were of Christian faith, and 50% of those were slave owners, but that's neither here nor there. In God We Trust has been written on our currency since 1957, when we added it in an attempt to distance ourselves from our Cold War enemy, the Soviet Union's state-implemented atheism. And as recently as 2014, the Supreme Court upheld their tradition of opening governmental meetings with overwhelmingly Christian prayer, declaring, quote, "As a practice that has long endured, legislative prayer has become part of our heritage and tradition, part of our expressive idiom, similar to the Pledge of Allegiance, inaugural prayer, or the resuscitation of God Save the United States in this honorable court at the opening of this court sessions." So the reason we should continue with prayers is 'cause prayers? Cool, got it. Today, the United States remains home to more Christians than any other country in the world,
with almost 70% of the population identifying as such.
And if you've been paying attention so far, and you better have, as there's going to be a test afterward, you know how the Bible views the weaker sex. While 70% of modern Americans may characterize themselves as Christians, Americans as a whole are less religious now than at any other time in our nation's history. People who don't claim a faith are second in numbers only to evangelical Protestants. Between President Obama's election in 2008 and Trump's election in 2016, America also transformed from a majority white Christian nation into a minority white Christian one. A fact that appears to fill white evangelical Protestants, 74% of whom claim things have, quote, changed for the worse since the racially segregated 50s, with such fear that 81% of them voted for Trump, a porn star porker who has spent his life acting in a decidedly hedonistic manner, yet tells them what they want to hear, that high-status groups like white Christian males somehow face more discrimination than minorities, Muslims, and women? Sure, dude. Their dedication to their fallible spray-tan savior is absolute. The Twitter bio of one zombified-looking female supporter I found reads, "Love Jesus Christ, my family, brethren, and friends. I thank Christ for the nation of USA, and I thank him for POTUS. God bless the USA." But, well, here I go getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to when America was great, shall we? In the Victorian era, the biblical concept of conjugal onanism, in which God smited a man because he didn't nut in his brother's wife, it's a long story, was used as proof that there was inherent sin in the use of all forms of contraception, including the withdrawal method. To many Christians at the time, preventing a pregnancy was tantamount to murder, a denial of God's will. Phrenologist and lecturer Orson Squire Fowler wrote, "Preventing conception outrages every sexual law. Think you, after God has created you men and women and ordained all this creative machinery solely to secure reproduction, you can thwart and cheat him without incurring his retribution commiserate with his highest law you break? Well, do you, punk?" The same went for the Catholics. In 1930, Pope Pius XI issued a papal encyclical declaring that any use whatsoever of matrimony exercised in such a way that the act is deliberately frustrated in its natural power to generate life is an offense against the law of God and of nature, and those who indulge in such are branded with the guilt of a grave sin. While pious people may like telling others what to do, they don't like being told what to do, even by members of the same faith. Which is why the 19th and 20th centuries saw the formation of hundreds of religious sects, offshoots of larger religions that took umbrage with the perceived failings of their parent denomination. Many women took on positions of power in these sects. From Mother Ann Lee of the Shakers to Mary Baker Eddy, founder of Christian Science, to Amy Semple McPherson, founder of the International Church of the Foursquare Gospel. The early 20th century sociologist Max Weber wrote that, while women were generally allowed more freedom and authority in these subsets when they first began, quote, only in very rare cases does this practice continue beyond the first stage of a religious community's formation. As routinization and regimentation of community relations sets in, authority previously allotted women diminishes, end quote. Women baked the 7-layer cakes of sex but weren't allowed to eat the finished products. Is this a good analogy, or am I just hungry? This is apparent in arguably the most famous sect of the 19th century, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which held, in its early days, surprisingly progressive attitudes for an organization mostly started to allow dudes to have multiple wives. A study of Mormon women's magazine articles tracing their subject matter from the 19th to the 20th century found that, prior to women earning the right to vote, the majority of articles advocated for women to seek out non-traditional roles and activities, to gain a formal education, work for a wage, and participate in politics. After 1921, however, articles exclusively emphasized the importance of women's roles as wives, homemakers, and mothers, told to, quote, multiply and replenish the earth. Today, the Mormon Church has staunchly taken a stand as a defender of traditional family values. The more time that passes and the more threatened sects feel by the outside secular world, the more these offshoots invariably end up resembling the gendered rigidity of their source material. While Charles Darwin, a chap who believed that while women were morally superior to men, they were inferior intellectually, was, to be sure, no feminist icon, his evolutionary theory was a great boon to the women's movement, as it challenged the idea that Eve emerged from Adam's rib. The scientific method also challenged the idea that differences between males and females were divinely ordained, which meant religions had to come up with fun, flirty new ways to dispel daffy dames of the idea that they deserved the same rights as gents. Indeed, from the beginning of feminism's first wave, religion rose as a response to women attempting to exercise their right to exist as anything but housefrous. Which makes sense.
Feminism is an upheaval of the status quo, a rewriting of the rules, and inherent in every religion, even the new ones,
is the importance of following them. The social hygiene programs that emerged in the 1920s were fear-based, Christian-backed responses to societal changes that arose as a result of urbanization. Notably, young people fraternizing with people of different races and women drinking, dancing, and rising their hemlines above the lower ankle. The concerns of conservative Christians of yesteryear, an increase in premarital sex, the breakdown of traditional family structure, and women seeking roles outside the home, echo those of today's. Isn't it delightfully depressing how little things change? The feminism of the mid-20th century was different than that of the early century. Instead of fighting for the right to vote, women were fighting for agency over their own bodies, and religious doctrine adjusted to reflect and restrict that. The rapid victories that occurred in women's rights throughout society in the 60s and 70s, not to mention the rights of homosexuals of both genders, triggered a knee-jerk reaction in the American church. White conservative Christians, perceiving the overall liberalization of society and removal of women from traditional gender roles as a threat, doubled down in the years that succeeded the sexual revolution. President Jimmy Carter, who briefly had their vote, shot himself in the foot by expressing support for the Equal Rights Amendment, which conservative political activist Phyllis Schlafly described as something that would undermine the protections women already had under the, quote, Christian tradition of chivalry. The death of the ERA in the late 70s can be seen as the end of the women's lib movement and the beginning of the rise of the new right. Republican presidential candidates like Ronald Reagan and George Bush, one, but also two, gained the trust of conservative Christians by echoing their faith and values, which included blurring the lines between church and state. Conservative Christians, feeling a little under attack by the secularization of society, developed a wee bit of a persecution complex. Jerry Falwell, a Southern Baptist pastor and founder of the Moral Majority, a conservative Christian lobbying group, claimed secularization, not radical Islamic extremism, caused 9/11, declaring, I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who have tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen. To them, America had lost sight of its Christian roots and, well, needed to be made great again. And what better way to do that than to focus on the family, that is, the traditional heteronormative concept of family. Conservative Christians took a hard stance against contraception and abortion, pushing for abstinence-only, purity-based sexual education, and pointed to the Bible as proof of the fact that women should, instead of behaving autonomously, submit to their husband's leadership. When telling women what to do with their lives, conservative Christians, much like kids, say the darndest things. President Paige Patterson of the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, one of the biggest seminaries of the world, almost 15 million Americans are Southern Baptists, which makes them the largest Protestant group in the United States, said abused wives should, instead of divorcing their husbands, focus instead on praying and, quote, being submissive in every way that they can, end quote. In a recently surfaced interview conducted with the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, he told the story of a battered woman who came to him for counsel and how he told her to pray to God to intervene. The woman, he said, came to him later with two black eyes. Quote, she said, I hope you're happy. And I said, yes, I'm very happy, because it turns out her husband had heard her quiet prayers and come for the first time to church the next day. Which reminds me of the old joke, what do you tell a woman with two black eyes? Don't sweat the small stuff. Regardless of how extreme a church's stance on traditional gender roles may be, the majority of Americans, two-thirds, belong to communities that prevent women from achieving leadership positions. In the 1970s, mainstream Protestants changed the rules so women could be officially ordained. Still, they were rarely put in positions of power and lacked career trajectory. In 2014, the female president of the Religious Research Association said that by mid-career, a full half of all clergywomen whose careers she were following had either left the congregational ministry or actively considering it due to these grievances. When it comes to Catholicism, for centuries the justifications for refusing women the ability to achieve priesthood have ranged from inherent sinfulness to their divine inferiority to man. Since both Christ and his apostles were male, the church surmised that God meant males were the only beings capable of becoming priests. As this was divine will, there could be no compromise on the matter. The fact that evidence exists that women served as deaconesses, priests, and bishops throughout the first three centuries of Christianity apparently is beside the point. Pope Francis, the current head of Catholicism and therefore the leader of an estimated 1.2 billion Catholics worldwide, has said the church, quote, needs to create still broader opportunities for a more incisive female presence. Former Irish President Mary McAleese, however, clapped back, declaring, quote, Pope Francis has said a deeper theology of woman is needed. God knows it would be hard to find a more shallow theology of women than the misogyny dressed up as the magisterium currently hides behind. Pope Francis, while very good at sounding woke, still refuses to extend full priesthood to women. While he thinks it's, quote, necessary to broaden the opportunities for a stronger presence of women in the church, he's, quote, wary of a solution that can be reduced to a kind of female machismo. Perish your thought. Which leads us to the words of Benedictine nun Joan Chittister. The church that preaches the equality of women but does nothing to demonstrate it within its own structures is dangerously close to repeating the theological errors that underlay centuries of church-sanctioned slavery. And yet, in spite of it all, more women than men identify as religious. 54% of Catholics, 55% of evangelical Protestants, 65% of Jehovah's Witnesses, and 54% of Mormons are women. Women are also more inclined than men to believe that Scripture is the word of God and should be taken literally. Understanding the Bible as a divine document to be read and interpreted literally is, well, impossible, unless you agree that if a woman doesn't bleed during sex on her wedding night, she should be stoned to death. Many non-religious feminists, myself included, wonder how these women can support a system designed to view them as lesser, but what we don't consider is the power that lies in being told that your creator is the one who made you lesser. God saying something is dogma carries far more weight than some random dude in a clip-on tie telling you the same. You absorb the message, and it becomes you. The anti-feminism is coming from inside the housewife. If you're a woman absorbing the message that God sees you as subordinate to men, so you have to do whatever they say, is the female equivalent of being in the sunken place. Thinking that God owns your body means you have no autonomy over it and helps you justify the rules that have been placed upon it. 79% of people who completely believe in God think abortion should be illegal in all cases. When you think a woman's body belongs to God, her termination of any life that's been placed within it, even by force, is naturally seen as an abandonment of her creator's will. Got beef with that? You've got beef with God. And, well, it's pretty hard to argue with God. I've tried it. I've lost every time.
It's weird how God can only transmit these important messages about women to men.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I guess it's that locker room talk thing that Trump talks about. They're just more comfortable.
I think heaven, yeah, is just a really big locker room.
I love the idea of the Christian tradition of chivalry.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to that?
Oh, you mean the tradition of only beating your wife with a stick that's smaller than a finger? Is that the Christian tradition of chivalry?
I think that is. Yeah, I think that is the tradition.
I mean, it's, yeah, it's better than a 2x4, I guess.
I like that idea, too, that about domestic violence, if you would just submit, mm-hmm. that would be, in fact, even better than just submitting. I think the real way to end domestic violence, it would be just for the majority of your marriage to play dead. Just cook a little something and get things pulled together in terms of housework and then just play dead for the rest of the afternoon and evening.
Well, you know, that's like they say, if you love what you do, you don't work a day in your life. I mean, if you play dead, then, you know, everything works its way out.
Chapter 5, Marriage and Family.
Spoke up in the bunker these last words on his wedding day. Before we die, Ava, hey, do me a favor and go put my laundry away. Putting the laundry away.
Baby, we reached the marriage and family chapter, finally.
Well, I'm really looking forward to another chance to talk about marital rape.
As am I. I mean, I feel like it's been at least 20 minutes since we last discussed it. I think I'm going to break out in hives.
I don't want to tip my hand exactly, but I do have a very special surprise coming up at the end of this chapter for a very certain someone. I'm not going to say who. Also, I'm pleased to announce that in this chapter, I'm pretty sure there are absolutely no indignities having to do with women.
And wait. Are you on drugs? Have we been reading the same subject matter? Have
well, you
learned
know,
nothing?
Well, look at it this way. The last couple chapters, sex, religion. Of course, there's going to be indignities in those chapters. I mean, those are indignity laden. But in a chapter like this about marriage and relationships, why would there be indignities for women when you consider how important these things are to women?
You mean because if mommy ain't happy, ain't nobody happy?
Exactly.
I mean, I read that on a tea towel once, but that doesn't mean that it's true.
I get everything from tea towels. Once I was having lunch with an aunt in her mid-80s, newly widowed after 58 years of wedded bliss. It had been a few years since her husband's passing, but she was still mourning his loss. So I said to her, "What was the key to such a long, happy relationship?" And she replied, "Well, dear, I'll tell you, it wasn't always easy. Not a day went by that he didn't make me cry." My jaw dropped. Then I said, "Well, then why do you think of it as a happy marriage?" To which she said, "Sweetheart, you learn to take the good with the bad." Which brings us to the point. For most of the years since it was invented, love was not connected to marriage. Because, as the ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, one of the few ancient Greeks who didn't discriminate against women and slaves, put it, love is nothing more than a mental disturbance, overwhelming and excruciatingly painful. He recommended a tranquil and friendly marriage with a good but homely woman, beauty being a disquieting prompt to excessive desire. And you know, he had a point, though my guess is that the tranquil, friendly woman would have preferred him to select a different descriptive adjective besides homely. Marriage was originally a business arrangement meant to forge alliances and solidify property holdings. The first recorded evidence of marriage contracts and ceremonies dates to 4,000 years ago in Mesopotamia. In the language of the ancient Sumerians, the word for love was literally a compound verb that meant to mark off land. In ancient Assyrian marriage laws, women had no right to property because their fathers or their husbands controlled everything.
A husband could give away property his wife brought into their marriage to anyone at any time. However, she could still be held responsible for all his debts. And his daughters could be enslaved in the name of paying them back. Seems fair to me. In those days, marriage was often kept within the family as a way to consolidate power, which is why the Egyptian pharaohs sometimes married their sisters, and the wealthy patriarchs in the Bible married their cousins. Thank God that ended before Ivanka married Eric. The through line was that women had almost no say over whom they married. Marriage was an economic arrangement that gifted a man with either a dowry or a bride price, then put that man legally in charge of the woman herself. In either case, if the family didn't pay up, the marriage was void. And if the marriage came apart, usually the man kept everything. The wedding ceremony was literally a legal transfer of the bride to the groom, kind of like taking title of a brand new car, which is why, traditionally, the bride shows up wearing a pink slip. I'm sorry. I apologize. That was a terrible joke. I'm so sorry. You deserve better. A terrifyingly clear example of this was the ceremony surrounding a marriage in ancient Rome, where, after the lavish wedding, all the principals participated in a weird little psychodrama in which the groom would pretend to rip the bride from the arms of her weeping mother while he and his friends sang dirty songs and made obscene jokes. It was basically a symbolism-laden ritual reminiscent of kidnapping and rape. Ha ha, what fun they had in the olden times. You know what they all used to say to each other? You're not losing a daughter, you're gaining a rapist. Kind of a shame that the budget wasn't big enough to include reenacting any dismemberment. Anyway, after that, the male members of the wedding party would lead the new bride in a public procession to the new husband's home, where they would stand outside the marital bedroom while the marriage was being consummated, singing a specially written obscene epithalamium, which was a poem for the marital chamber. I have no idea how anyone managed to do any consummating while that was going on. A famous epithalamium written by the Latin poet Catullus went, "Raise, boys, your torches, raise them high. I see the scarf of crimson nigh, on to her home the bride to bring. And as ye move, in measure sing, hail Hymen, Hymenaeus." The hilarity and the merriment. Oh, that we could revive that custom now. Seriously, though, if a group of my friends ever tried that on me, I'd run out naked with a scabbard between my teeth, making growling, guttural noises so terrifying they'd be reenacted at campfires as ghost stories for centuries. The early Christians, on the other hand, went in a different direction by valuing celibacy above marriage. Because St. Paul said marriage interfered with forming a union with the Lord and gave man a divided mind. And a man's mind really can't take any more divisions, in my opinion. Of course, Jesus was no fan of divorce. He's the one who said, "What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder," thus starting not only just a long trend of people trying to remain married, but also launching the only known use of the word asunder. In them days, Christianity liked meting out strong punishment for adultery, culminating perhaps in 14th century Germany, where adulterers were both impaled and buried alive, which to me seems like double dipping. In many places, the punishments were different for men and women. In Sicily in 1231, a male adulterer had his property confiscated, whereas a woman adulterer just got her nose slit. I guess she lucked out because she had no property. In ancient Egypt, arranged marriages were the norm, but there were also bridal auctions where women were sold to the highest bidder. Certainly two wonderful ways for any young couple to start a new life. Of course, the real purpose of the Egyptian marriage was to have children, but they had some interesting ideas about birth control. One idea was putting a hardened plug of crocodile excrement into the vagina. If this ever worked, it was probably by causing men to mysteriously not be in the mood anymore. Another fun fact, with so many people living along the Nile River, its water wasn't safe to drink, so Egyptian children and adults both drank a lot of beer. Welcome to the age of drunken toddlers. And you thought the terrible twos were bad now. As for divorce, any Egyptian man or woman who wished to do so could become divorced by simply announcing in front of witnesses that the marriage was over. But since there was no such thing as joint marital property, wait a minute, I think we've heard this one before. Oh, that's right. The man got to keep everything, including the children. On to my favorite misogynistic culture, ancient Greece, where it's no surprise that marriages were mainly property and financial transactions meant to facilitate procreation. But the Greeks added a lovely idea of confining the women to separate quarters within the house and keeping them closed off from the men's apartments by a locked door. Because, you know, the wives and the daughters are not fit to participate in the intellectual experiences taking place in the men's quarters. Which I assume meant then, as now, drinking beer and talking about which nude all-male sports events you preferred. In fact, a husband was within his rights to lock his wife up in the house whenever she wasn't behaving as he wished. Therefore, she was only seen publicly at religious events, weddings, and funerals, perhaps for camouflage reasons, so if she showed up looking miserable, he could explain, "Oh, you know Alexia, she always cries at weddings and funerals. It's totally not about her being locked up." In ancient Rome, Roman fathers were responsible for finding suitable matches for their daughters, who were, of course, expected to be virgins. Roman men, on the other hand, were entitled to as many additional sex partners as they could manage to find. But even a nightmarish Roman marriage could not be terminated by the Roman wife. Her only recourse was to move back in with her father, and there was a no-return policy on daughters after they'd given birth. Plus, here's a surprise, after a divorce, a wife's property was returned to her father or male guardian, and she would lose all rights to her children and everything else. They also had what I like to call the lucky lady law, written on behalf of any woman who felt she'd been married solely for her money and then ignored after she produced an heir. Thanks to the lucky lady law, trademark pending, a Roman woman could legally compel her creepy user to have sexual relations with her a minimum of 3 times a month. So in other words, she was still entitled to plenty more of that good user sex. Imagine how great. Kudos, lucky lady. But guess what? By the late Roman Republic, the idea of a couple as a husband and wife partnership involving mutual affection was starting to catch on, though they'd be ridiculed for showing too much emotion. A Roman politician was expelled from the Senate in the 2nd century for kissing his wife in public, behavior the essayist Plutarch condemned as disgraceful. As our friend Epicurus tried to warn everyone, love crazes the mind and leads to heartache. But sex without passionate attachment produces a superior form of pleasure, free of uncertainty, frenzy, and mental disturbance. You know, it's too bad there are no writings from women during this period. It's not hard to guess what the ones who dated Epicurus would have been saying. It would start with a Roman version of the word, ugh. Among the elite class in Rome, there were lots of divorces, but, say it with me, only the man could initiate a divorce. Divorce was so looked down upon that Emperor Constantine in the mid-300s issued an edict imposing serious penalties on one-sided divorce filing. A woman needed to prove her husband was a murderer, a preparer of poison, or a disturber of tombs, or she would lose her dowry and be deported to an island. Which, depending on the island, sounds kind of preferable. Though I bet the preparer of poison guys were kind of a hot date. By 421, something called the Theodosian Code lightened things up by declaring that a woman seeking divorce only needed to prove her husband guilty of vices and middling faults, a phrase which basically describes every man I ever dated. Otherwise, she shall lose her marriage gift and dowry and be deported for life. Plus, she can never marry again. Shh! If you listen carefully, you can still hear the Roman women all fake crying. Before we leave ancient Rome, an excerpt from the poem Ars Amatoria, written in 2 AD by the poet Ovid, who teaches weirdly timeless male-female relationship techniques covering topics like not forgetting her birthday and not asking about her age. Don't let your hair stick up in tufts on your head, he counsels the male suitor, and don't have any hair growing out of your nostrils. Take care that your breath is sweet, and don't go about reeking like a billy goat. All other toilet refinements leave to the women or to perverts. Proving once again that reeking like a billy goat is never good, no matter what the century. And if you needed to borrow a restroom, stick with the women and the perverts. By the 5th century, even though the Roman Empire collapsed, the church got bigger in the marriage game, culminating in 1215 when it made marriage one of the church's 7 sacraments alongside rites like baptism and penance. And the more the church got involved, the more dogma everyone heard about pleasure being sinful. Wives who especially were warned not to enjoy themselves, but to be a passive recipient during the act. And we all know how much men love a completely passive recipient. Thomas Aquinas warned that a man who slept with his wife solely for pleasure was treating her like a prostitute, accidentally triggering a kink that lives on to this day. By the Middle Ages, a woman's dowry was still the big thing. the offering of goods, animals, and land to the husband for taking a daughter off her dad's hands. Plus, the wife was also supposed to be able to tend livestock, make butter, prepare meals, milk cows, tend the vegetable garden, fetch water, do laundry at the stream, spin, sew, nurse babies, care for the sick and the elderly, help in the fields with hoeing, weeding, harvesting, and gleaning. Jeez, this reminds me so much of me, especially the gleaning. Which is probably why, by the 12th and 13th centuries, the European aristocracy had begun to view extramarital affairs as the highest form of romance, an escape from the harshness of daily life. There were many popular songs about unhappy cheating wives who, oddly enough, were unburdened by feelings of guilt. Now for a